right, welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate. Today's show, it's going to be two big areas of concentration, all right? At the back end of the show, we're going to be talking with Sansara Taylor, writer for Revolution Newspaper and a founder of End Pornography and Patriarchy, the Enslavement and Degradation of Women. And we're going to be talking with Sansara about the upcoming nationwide pro-abortion protests on the anniversary of Roe v. Wade next weekend, all right? And it's confronting all those fascists that are going to be out there launching and intensifying the war against women in this country as it concentrates on and is targeted on abortion rights. So we'll be talking with Sansara about all that. But opening the show up, I'm very pleased. And as I say pleased, I am pleased to be having my next guest, my first guest on the show. He's Dr. Terry Coopers. And Dr. Coopers is a psychiatrist and expert on the psychological effects of prison conditions. Last year, Terry Coopers investigated conditions at the East Mississippi Correctional Facility and wrote that these conditions can accurately be described as torture, according to international human rights agreements and standards. And there is currently a lawsuit going on that's from the Southern Poverty Law Center and the ACLU going up against what's happening at the East Mississippi Correctional Facility. And Terry is here to join us today. And Terry, welcome back to the show.
Thank you. Happy to be with you.
Yeah. You know, it's something, you know, when I first spoke with you many years ago, we were talking about Pelican Bay. Then the last time I spoke with you, we were talking about Pelican Bay and the Supermax prisons and the horrible conditions in there. And then you pop up on this one, and I thought, damn, man, this is because in terms of graphic and nauseating descriptions of things, conditions, this really is something that's so far out there, it's very, very difficult to believe. Now, go ahead.
That's true. I think we've gotten into a very unfortunate situation where correctional management now depends on isolation to a great extent. And that's because there aren't the resources to do the rehabilitation programs that prisoners need to succeed at going straight after they're released. There's overcrowding in the prisons. So what happens is the prisons get out of control. And instead of fixing the problem, which is to uncrowd the prisons by, for instance, radically changing sentencing, and to buff up the rehabilitation programs so that people will be fairly satisfied with their activities and prepare to succeed out in the outside world, instead the powers that be decide that the problem is a certain number of bad apples among the prisoners, what they call the worst of the worst, and they lock them up in solitary and leave them there to rot, essentially. It destroys people. I think it reaches the definition of torture by international standards. And in the United States, the issue is the Eighth Amendment. We're supposed to be free of cruel and unusual punishment. But solitary confinement, especially indeterminate solitary, is cruel and unusual punishment.
But there's something even more going on at this East Mississippi Correctional Facility as well, at least according to the report. When I read your work on it, your report on it, and other newspaper coverage of it, it's very heavy here because this is, I mean, you know, it's you can't keep using this metaphor over and over again, but it is like the old snake pit days when you're looking at prisons and people that were supposed to be getting mental health care and the way that people were kept. And you talked about this being torture, but you also said that it was the worst that you had seen in your entire career. Now, that's a pretty heavy statement for someone who's seen a hell of a lot.
Yes. Well, let me give a little bit of background. Mississippi did have a supermax prison that was very much like Pelican Bay and the SHU at Pelican Bay, which is a solitary confinement unit that's one of the harshest in the country, and there's current litigation against that, which began with the hunger strikes in California. Mississippi had a Unit 32 at Parchman, which the ACLU National Prison Project sued over. And that was because the conditions there were absolutely horrendous. The temperature was very high, it was very humid, but the prisoners had to close their windows because there was a pest infestation, mosquitoes and even water moccasins coming on to the units. The toilets didn't work, they backed up, they flooded the prisoners' cells, so they were always in excrement, and it was just absolutely inhumane conditions. Well, Mississippi cleaned that up. As a result of the lawsuit, after going to court several times, and each time the prisoners, which is the plaintiff class, prevailed, Mississippi decided to change that and downsize that supermax and decrease the number of people around the state who are in solitary confinement. So they actually did very well, and in the meanwhile, they created mental health programs for the people who tended to get locked up in solitary who had serious mental illness. But then a few years later, we discovered that another prison, the Eastern Mississippi Correctional Facility, was actually becoming just as bad as Unit 32 had been previously. It's the designated mental health facility for the state prison system, but in fact, there's almost nothing in the way of mental health care going on there. Most of the prisoners who are severely disturbed are kept in isolation. The conditions in isolation, and that's where I said this is the worst I've seen. The lights go out, and the authorities don't even fix the lights so that the men are in total darkness 24 hours a day. There's very little in the way of mental health care, and then there, instead of mental health care, they go around and inject the prisoners involuntarily with Haldol and other strong antipsychotic tranquilizers. This is totally unacceptable, both in terms of the awful conditions and in terms of the atrociously inadequate mental health care.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's very heavy, and I want to get into some of those things that you were bringing up as we go along, because I want people to really understand what the reality of this is. This is a prison that actually is run by a private firm, right? But it's still part of the Mississippi State system.
Yes, the Management and Training Corporation, which is a private contractor to the state of Mississippi. And what tends to happen with private contractors is, you know, they make their profit. They are for-profit companies. They make their profit by saving on salaries. So they tend to have less experienced, less well-trained staff, fewer staff. So one of the complaints of the prisoners in solitary at the Eastern Mississippi facility, it's in Meridian, by the way, is that the staff never come to their cell. When you're locked in a cell and you can't get out and there's nothing that you can do, if your light goes out or the water doesn't work or there's an emergency, you need staff to come by to check on you to see how you're doing and get you to the medical if you need it and such. Well, the staff would not come by for an entire shift, and people were just left to their own devices in their cell. And so that's where the people with mental illness just deteriorate to a great extent. Well, the reason for that, obviously, is that the corporation was not hiring enough staff to come by in a timely fashion and find out what the needs are of the prisoners.
Yeah. Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Dr. Terry Coopers, a psychiatrist and expert on the psychological effects of prison conditions. And we're talking in particular about the conditions at the East Mississippi Correctional Facility, which Dr. Coopers has declared are the conditions that can accurately be described as torture, according to international human rights agreements and standards, and the worst things that he's seen in his entire career. Now, Terry, one of the things that really struck me in reading about this is this combination of brutality and neglect. You know, when you were talking about this mental health issue, there's, as I understand it, there's actually, what, like 70% of the inmates that are in the Eastern Mississippi Correctional Facility are mentally ill to one degree or another. And they face this combination of intense brutality and neglect, which to me in itself has to be something that's really torturous.
Absolutely. What we need to look at is the long-term damage. Someone who has a serious mental illness, for instance, schizophrenia, and has psychotic episodes, they're intermittent, and in between, one hopes there's a remission. And what we do in psychiatry is we work very hard to keep the time that the individual is in a psychotic state to a minimum, because the prognosis, their eventual outcome, is much better if we can clear up the psychosis quickly and if they spend most of their time in remission. You take that same individual who, in adequate treatment and with fair housing and some kind of a comfortable life, would do fairly well, even though they have the illness, schizophrenia. Put them in a prison environment that, in fact, induces psychosis. And solitary confinement is well known to induce psychosis. I've been studying that my entire career and publishing about that. So you take this individual who is prone to psychotic episodes, put him in a solitary cell, and then deny him adequate treatment. So he's in solitary, which tends to induce and exacerbate psychosis, and he is not getting treatment. What ends up happening is he spends all of his time in a psychotic state. There is no remission, and the longer he spends in a psychotic state, the worse his eventual outcome will be. So he's basically being destroyed, and that's the problem with this kind of double jeopardy of isolation, which induces psychosis, and then a lack of treatment.
So this idea of this isolation and this fact of neglect, that has very real terms in terms of health, life, and death.
Yes, I'm not sure what your question was.
It's kind of stunning because when you look at this, there's actually this point of exactly what you're saying. You know, there's this point of what happens to people. And I was thinking about this in relation to even when people do try to get, you know, to get help, that they try to make their needs known. And I mean, it's just amazing that if you could tell people a little bit about what the visceral portrayal of what happens, because, you know, reading these things where people have actually been, you know, a guy died and they kept issuing reports that he was living and fine, or, you know, all these things that happen when people stick their arms through the feeding slot in order to try and get help, and then they're punished.
That's right. And what happens is that many of the prisoners told me that the people have heart attacks in these places in solitary confinement. And the prisoners all know who's having a heart attack because the person starts saying out loud and then getting louder and louder when no one comes to their aid. So you've got a prisoner in the next cell or three cells down yelling that my heart is hurting, my chest is hurting, I'm afraid I'm having a heart attack. And then that individual becomes silent in an hour or something. And meanwhile, no one has come to help them, and they die. Now, the person who's left to survive, who was the neighbor of that person who died unattended by a heart attack, their anxiety level goes up sky high because they're afraid that if something like that happened to them, no one would come to help them. So what happens is everybody escalates their plea for help, and it's a legitimate plea for help. So when they need something, for instance, they run out of toilet paper or their light doesn't work or their toilet overflows, which is quite common because the plumbing is so bad, instead of just asking an officer who's passing by in a calm tone, would you get someone in here to fix my toilet, please, they start screaming. And then what you hear in these units is loud screaming from all directions, because there's no staff there to attend to what are the desperate needs of the prisoners. Let me just step back from this for a moment to say that this is not an accidental occurrence, nor is it a rare event, what's going on in the Eastern Mississippi Correctional Facility. What we are doing out here in society is ignoring disadvantaged people. So one group is people with serious mental illness. Our public mental health system has been diminishing in its efficacy for 30, 40 years. The budgets are cut each year. It's almost impossible for someone with a mental illness who is low income, and most people in prison are low income, to get adequate services. And then they eventually get arrested and go to prison. I call the process disappearing. What our society is doing is neglecting the needs of the disadvantaged, which I think is our social responsibility to take care of them. And then we don't want to see the result, which is people who are, frankly, psychotic out on the street. So we arrest them for various things, often a minor offense, drug possession or panhandling in an ATM. And we put them behind bars, at which point the public forgets about them. And then these awful abuses occur and nobody hears them screaming.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it brings me to my next question, because you started to talk about the impact of segregation on prisoners being segregated, doing solitary and the rest of that. And then there's something that really struck me in part of what you wrote about the darkness issue, because I want people to understand that this is not a matter of a light bulb goes out and you got to wait till morning when there's somebody comes around and has a key to the utility closet and get you a new light bulb. This is actually a situation that is part of this torture that you refer to in your comment about the situation at the prison, because this darkness is something that people are forced to live in for weeks, if not months at a time, I understand.
That's correct. Special Rapporteur Mendez of the United Nations said, keeping someone in isolation for more than 15 days is a human rights abuse, basically a tantamount to torture. Well, here we have a situation where they're kept in isolation, which in itself is an abuse, and then they're not allowed a light bulb, they don't have a functioning toilet. What happens is the prisoners react in increasingly extreme ways. So a lot of prisoners set fires, and they're setting fires almost as a desperate plea for help. They're also mentally disordered, so there's a setting of fires, there's a lot of self-harm, they will cut themselves. and the officers passing by will see that they've cut themselves and will say, I'm not going to respond to that. You're just trying to manipulate. So you've got this prisoner who's psychotic in a cell bleeding, and nobody's doing anything. And I saw that over and over again.
Mm. Now, on this darkness thing again, just because I was really moved by something that you said. You know, you talked about how human beings actually, because a lot of what we're talking about gets to the essence of, are people being dehumanized or are they being treated like humans? And even in terms of darkness and light, that people need that rhythm between darkness and life as part of the basic human functioning. And that this actual keeping people in total darkness for so long is a big part of the dehumanization as well.
Yes. Well, we have a tremendous amount of research in the social sciences that if deprived of certain basic needs, human beings will become psychotic and actually will, many of them will kill themselves. And one is the diurnal rhythm. It's an epidemic in prisons around the country that prisoners don't sleep at night. And in solitary confinement, the problem is that the lights are on all the time. So whether the lights are on all the time, which is the complaint of many prisoners in other solitary confinement units, or they're off all the time, what's missing is a normal diurnal cycle where people sleep at night and work during the daytime, or people on graveyard shift do the opposite, but they do it in some kind of ordered fashion. And when you take that away, when you leave the lights on all night long, or the other thing that happens is there's noise all night, the slamming of cell doors, officers kind of ordering people to do things in the middle of the night, so the prisoners don't get enough sleep. So there's the lack of the diurnal rhythm and sleep deprivation, both of which tend to make people who are prone to psychosis more likely psychotic and tend to make the psychotic episode or depressive episode worse. And that's why we have a epidemic of suicides in the prisons.
You know, one of the things that also stood out to me was the idea that as people are fed in these cells that they're in and their food is pushed through a little slot, and that slot is also used, apparently, from what I can tell, even including in part of the feeding process, is used, again, to reduce people to something less than human. The idea that the food oftentimes is just shoved in onto a mattress and people are forced to stand back against the wall if they want to eat. The portal is also used as a way to shoot gas into the prison cells. It's astounding that kind of stuff is what's going on.
Yes, you know, there's a basic level of human dignity which you cannot deprive people, even the most depraved people in the world. So you have someone who's locked in a solitary cell, and the staff are not attending to their basic needs and leaving them there just to suffer. And then what happens is these people are objectified. The officers treat them, and the prisoners say this, they'll start out with a mild complaint of, I don't get any respect here. And then it moves on to, they're treating me like an animal. One of the things that happens in this prison, and I've seen it in other extreme situations, prisoners of war do this, where there's no attention to the very legitimate basic needs of the prisoners. The prisoners do more extreme things in order to get the attention they need. So one of the things the prisoners do after nobody has responded to their call, for instance, that they need to see the doctor, and no one does anything to get them to see the doctor. Well, this could be an emergency. We don't know yet until they see the doctor. So what they will do is put their arm through the food port. It's a solid metal door to their cell. So they're in the dark in a cell with a light bulb, say, not working, for instance. And the officer comes by to give them a food tray, and they stick their arm out the food port. Well, the officers, as a punishment for that, and the officers are under a lot of stress, too, and they're overworked, they're understaffed, underpaid. What they will do is get angry at the prisoner, and they'll say, I'm not going to give you your food unless, and that's what you mentioned, unless you put your mattress on the floor next to the door and go back to the other side of the cell and kneel down, then I will throw your food tray in on your mattress. Well, this is a bizarre and classically torture situation, and what the prisoners do is that they don't eat. They say, I'm not going to do that. First of all, I don't want my food thrown on the mattress. It's like throwing it on the floor. And second of all, you're treating me like an animal. That's not okay. So they would rather starve than be treated like an animal. And that's the kind of extremity that goes on in these places. And again, people on the outside don't know this is going on.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Dr. Terry Coopers, a psychiatrist and expert on psychological effects of prison conditions. And we're talking about the conditions at the East Mississippi Correctional Facility. Terry, you know, one of the things, too, is that I kept thinking, and you referred to this a lot in what you wrote, you know, did nobody do any reports? Was there, I mean, you mentioned one person that actually did some reports that had any real merit or meaning. I think it was a woman who was working there. But where are the reports here, and what kind of reports were there? Because if they're keeping any kind of medical file or any kind of reports on this, one would think that somebody somewhere would stumble on this stuff and say, whoa, what the hell's going on here? What about report making, report taking?
Well, I think lawsuits are very important because, yes, you would think someone would complain about this, but in fact they don't. And there's a lot of very strong interest groups that are interested, and they're generally called the prison industrial complex, the people who build the prisons, the private companies that run them for profit, people who supply food, people who supply the military type of security mechanisms. All of these people want the prison population to expand so they'll make more money. And then it does not come under review. There are all kinds of state review mechanisms that ought to close the prisons down when they're operating at this level of indecency and torture. But in fact, they don't work. So the prisoners themselves have to sue. And then the lawsuit occurs. Lawsuits accomplish something, but you know, when we do a lawsuit, what we say is the conditions in the prisons are beneath the standard of constitutionality. They violate the prohibition against cruel and unusual punishment. And a judge decides something about that. Well, every time a judge decides that, they decide that it's not okay to do something, but it's okay to do something else. So in the Madrid v. Gomez case, which was in California about Pelican Bay Prison back in the early 90s, Judge Henderson, who is the most progressive judge in the country, decided that it's not okay to put people with mental illness in the Pelican Bay SHU, or Supermax Isolation Unit. But he did not rule that it was unconstitutional to run the SHU. So that SHU continued to operate and operates still. And now we have the case Ruiz versus Brown, where we're trying to inject a little decency into the way that SHU is run. So lawsuits are not the entire solution. There has to be public outrage about what's going on in the prisons.
Absolutely.
There are 2.5 million people in jail and prison, and that means there's probably 10 or 20 million people who have spent a considerable amount of time there. A lot of them have serious mental illness, which has gone untreated so that their condition has gotten worse. And it's time for the public to say, enough, we're not going to tolerate this and call this a democracy.
Mm-hmm. One of the terrible things is, but a terrible truth is that when that outrage is not there, it says a hell of a lot about us as a people. What kind of morality do we have? What kind of value do we put on human life? And what kind of society are we willing to tolerate? You know, I have one question for you, Terry, one last question. This is really one of those things that kind of gets you and says, wait a minute, this isn't right. This is not the first time that you investigated this prison. You actually went through it earlier, a number of years ago, and issued a report that probably had similar things in it in terms of what's going on and the need to dramatically change all this. That was the case, right? You did review this and make suggestions, and then you come back and find out that not much has really been done, or it's gotten worse.
Well, it's really outrageous, and it upsets me a great deal. I lose a lot of sleep over this. It's a contradiction about our democracy. I think what happens is that we all think we live in a democracy, and in a democracy, of course, if someone's mentally ill, they're going to get treatment because the purpose of government is to take care of the most disadvantaged people. Well, the truth is far from that. The truth is that they don't get the treatment they need, and they get thrown in jail where actually they're abused in a much worse fashion. I think we have trouble handling, we being citizens in general, we have trouble handling that contradiction. So we're happy to have the people who are most disadvantaged and abused thrown into prison where they're, you know, we talk about lock them up and throw away the key. What that means is that they can do anything they want to them in there and nobody's going to care. And we've been doing that for a lot of years, and it's time for the citizenry to deal with the contradiction that we supposedly live in a democracy where we take care of the most disadvantaged, but in fact, we torture them in prison. And that's a very difficult contradiction to confront, but I think we need to confront it, and we need to do something to clean it up.
All right, Dr. Terry Coopers, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you, Michael. It's a pleasure.
Yeah, always a pleasure to talk with you too, man. Hopefully we'll talk again soon, maybe on something happier, okay? All right.
Bye.
All right, Terry, take care. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we've just been talking with Dr. Terry Coopers, a psychiatrist and expert on the psychological effects of prison conditions. Last year, he investigated conditions at the East Mississippi Correctional Facility and wrote that those conditions can accurately be described as torture, according to international human rights agreements and standards. We're going to take a quick break and be right back with Sansara Taylor to talk about what's coming up next weekend in terms of standing up against the Christian fascists and the assault on women.
Woman is the nigger of the world. Yes, she is. Think about it. Woman is the nigger of the world. Think about it. Do something about it. We'll make her paint her face and dance. She won't be a slave, we say that she don't love us. If she's real, we say she's trying to be a man. By putting her down, we pretend so hard that she's above us. Woman is the nigger of the world. Yes, she is. Don't believe me, take a look at the one you're with. Woman is the slave of the slave. Ah, yeah. If you believe me, you better scream about it.
All right, welcome back. A voice that I wish we could hear a lot more of in times like today. It's John Lennon telling some truth. All right? That's right. Let's move right into, because I want to get every minute out of this segment, all right? Next week, the Christian fascists are launching their anti-women demonstrations, their march to basically advocate the enslavement of women. And it's focused up around abortion rights and the assault on abortion and the anniversary of Roe v. Wade, the Supreme Court decision that actually legalized abortion many, many years ago. So next weekend, that's happening. And joining us to talk about this today is Sansara Taylor. Sansara is a writer for Revolution Newspaper and a founder of End Pornography and Patriarchy, the Enslavement and Degradation of Women. And we're going to talk with her about what's going on, what's behind it, what the outlook is, why it's happening, and all that. Sansara, welcome back to the show.
Hey, Michael. How are you?
I'm good. Good. And you?
I'm great. Thank you.
Okay. Let's jump into this because I want to get every minute out of you. Okay? Here you go.
Okay,
Stop Patriarchy issued this call for people everywhere to come to New York City on January 22nd or San Francisco on the 24th to confront the anti-abortion women haters who will be marching in a full-scale frontal assault on abortion. What are we talking about here? This seems that this is a moment, and I know, you know, it's not unlike what you were talking with us about back last summer about the abortion freedom ride in Texas, but it seems to be things are even more developed and more sort of ratcheted up. This moment that we're talking about right now is very decisive, and I wanted you to kind of explain that. Give us an overview of what's going to happen next week. Why is it so damn important?
Well, I think in very, very basic terms, we have to all look soberly at the fact that in this country there is a very powerful Christian fascist movement that is deeply entrenched in the halls of power, and they're seriously taking away women's right to abortion as a part of a larger assault on the fundamental humanity of women. It's a part of a larger assault. They are doing this. They are making great gains. They must be stopped, and we're the ones who have to stop them. It's not going to go away on its own. And it's true. You and I have been talking about this on air for quite a few years now. And this war on women and the war on abortion rights has been going on for decades. But there's a way in which, as opposed to the notion that okay, well, it's still going on. It's still going on. They said emergency last year, and they're saying emergency now again. So that's just the background noise. Actually, the emergency, as you're saying, has been intensifying. We are in a period where every record in terms of abortion restriction keeps getting broken. In the last 3 years, I believe it's 231 laws have been enacted across the country restricting women's right to abortion. That's more than in the previous decade. And when women don't have access to abortion, just to cut to the heart of the matter, women don't have access to abortion, that means that they are forced to have children against their will. They are enslaved in that way. Or they are forced to risk their lives and risk prison to terminate an unwanted pregnancy. And that's something that should not be accepted by anybody, but it is going on. First of all, it's going on all over the world in countries all over the world, but it's also going on in growing sections of this country in places like the Rio Grande Valley near the U.S.-Mexican border, in Texas, in places like rural Mississippi, in places like western Pennsylvania, where not that long ago a woman was imprisoned for assisting her daughter in getting the abortion pill off the internet because they couldn't get to a clinic. They didn't have the insurance. They couldn't afford it. And it was 80 miles away, and she was working. So these are the kinds of conditions that are already being forced back upon women, and it's going to continue to get worse until people stand up and stop it. And so that's the mission that Stop Patriarchy has been spearheading, including through the protests that we're organizing over the next week.
Mm-hmm. Now, let me ask you this, because as we're talking about this, and you can see this, I mean, we have this new Congress, this new Senate and House of Representatives. You know, everybody's talking about, oh, well, you know, this is, you know, you've got the Republicans are just like full force out there, and all the whack jobs and all that stuff are out there. And then you look at what they're doing. One of the first things that they did was to assault abortion rights, the no abortion after 20 weeks. And this is sort of something that really sort of, I think, should snap people's head around, because they are hell-bent on carrying this attack out and pushing women back into their subordinate place, their place as a slave and a server of men. What is it that we're up against right now when you look at something like that?
I mean, I agree with you. I just have to bring this in. It's been something that's been driving me crazy. Right now, we're coming off of this, and it speaks to what you're raising, but we're coming off of this week where there was this horrific attack in Paris. This may seem off subject, but bear with me. There was this horrific attack in Paris on the newspaper there, Charlie Hebdo, and it's not a good thing. It's a nightmare what went down there. But now you have all these imperialist leaders in the West thumping their chests and saying, I am Charlie Hebdo. I am a opponent of fundamentalist fanaticism. I don't want to see this happen. I'm a champion of free expression and the rights of the people, including the rights of women. And I just want to say, and yet you don't hear one word from them, including the rulers of this country and the so-called leaders of the free world, about the fundamentalist fanatics on their own soil. And when George Tiller was assassinated by a Christian fascist, when the heroic George Tiller abortion provider did late-term abortions, risked his life, was stalked for decades, his face had a wanted poster made with his image on it, and his address was distributed, and this went on for decades, and then he was assassinated by Christian fascists. Where were the rulers who said, I am George Tiller. I stand against this fanaticism? And it's every bit as dark ages as the Islamic fundamentalists. It's every bit, the Christian fascist movement in this country is every bit as dark ages and extreme as any Islamic cleric or mullah anywhere on this planet who's a fundamentalist of that religion. And I just think in this country, this variety of fundamentalism, this variety of women's enslavement is treated as a matter of taste. It's treated as legitimate. And frankly, they don't need to do most of their dirty work in this country through extra legal terror, through bombing clinics, through killing doctors. They still do it, but they don't need to, because exactly what you're pointing to, they're using the force of the state itself to restrict and take away women's rights. They are pushing their agenda through the so-called legitimate means of introducing on their first day of Congress a 20-week ban on abortion. You know, and nobody's calling them out. Nobody in the halls of power is talking about them. They're treating them as reasonable, legitimate, a difference of opinion, people we can seek common ground with. And yet, this is part of an assault that will not stop until all abortions for all women have been restricted in all circumstances, and birth control, by the way. It's revealing that, yes, there are these, and people are right to be alarmed by this new Congress that is even more nakedly, even more openly fascist. But it's an illusion to think that it's just them. It's deeper, it's entrenched in this system. If you have one half of your ruling class, the Republican Party, are openly fascist, and the other half says that they're legitimate. Well, what does that say about your whole system? That the whole thing is set up, the whole thing is illegitimate, the whole thing is rooted in patriarchy, as well as other forms of oppression and exploitation. And so, yes, this actually has to be fought. It will not go away by itself. It also means we need to make a revolution, and we need to fight it in such a way that's building up the strength to make that revolution, that's getting into where this comes from and how we put an end to it once and for all by getting rid of this system. But as we do that, people need to come together from different perspectives, including right now in a very immediate way, to say that this 20-week ban must not be allowed to go forward. Mm-hmm. That the cases working their way through the, up through the courts all over the country, these new laws that have been restricting abortion, that will be heard sooner or later at the Supreme Court. When that happens, there has to be a situation where thousands and tens of thousands and before long, literally millions of people are going into the streets saying, no, we will not accept this. We have to change the political climate and the terms before, you know, relying on ourselves before this is taken entirely away from women.
Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Sansara Taylor, writer for Revolution Newspaper and RevCom.us, and also the, one of the founders of End Pornography and Patriarchy, The Enslavement and Degradation of Women. And we're talking about the assault on women and the need for people to stand up against this. And in particular, we're going to be focused up around the nationwide protests against the Christian fascists next weekend in New York and in San Francisco. Now, Sansara, there's something as you're talking, I kept thinking about this point that you've made a couple times in your writings and what you were indicating just now when you were talking about taste, that this stuff is a matter of taste. And there is really this torrent of woman-hating that you've pointed to that's being unleashed and the whole culture of hatred on every front in relation to women. And at the same time, there's something else that's on the scene, which I think is extremely important to talk about too. And we saw this begin in what happened in Texas and the abortion rights freedom ride, and then what was going on in Ferguson and New York, and all the way things have changed in a certain sense. They've changed dramatically since last summer, both in the assaults on people, on women in particular, and on people, and also in terms of the willingness or the what's happening, the resistance among the people. And that seems to me, that's something that's really got to be built off of in relation to this whole assault, and in particular in relation to the thing next weekend.
No, I think one of the things, you're absolutely right, one of the things that is important for people to grasp overall is what a huge difference it has made that people stood up this past summer, in particular against the murder of our youth, Black and Latino youth, at the hands of the police, in particular rising up against that, but also in other ways, and that it has made a huge difference. What was different is not that these youth were being murdered by the police, but what was different, that goes on all the time, but what was different is people were standing up, they were saying no more, they were blocking traffic, they were shutting down freeways, they were sports figures, were wearing the T-shirts and the games, and this was changing what everybody had to deal with and giving a lot of heart and a lot of inspiration. That has to go forward, but there are also lessons in that. There are lessons in that for people who want to see all forms of oppression ended. That if you want to stop, if you don't want to accept what we're being told should just be part of the background noise, part of the routine functioning of America, the murder of the youth by the police, the shutting down of women's access to abortion rights, the systematic rape and abuse that women face in their homes, on the campuses, at their workplaces, and in countless other places. If you don't think that that should just be the background noise, the destruction of the environment, all these things, you have to get out there. You have to be part of relying on ourselves and fighting back and resisting. And that's how you wake other people up. That's how you build up the strength to put a stop to these outrages, because it will not be stopped by the system and by the powers that rule over us. And so I think there's a lot of lessons in that. And then I also think one of the things that is really important for people to grasp is the challenge to not only continue on each of these fronts of struggle in their own right, but also to make the leap from fighters on one front to fighters on all fronts. Because if you really look at it, all of these outrages are rooted in the same system. Now, that's a big statement. There's a lot of science behind what I'm saying, you know, that it, we could talk about why that's so. But the oppression of Black people, the terror and the mass incarceration that is grinding up so many lives in poor and oppressed communities is rooted in the workings of this system every bit as much as the oppression of women is woven into the economics, to the culture, to the social relations, and to every part of the functioning of this system. Every bit as much as the fact that it sits on top of the world and sends its drones and its torture and occupations all over the world to plunder and get resources and maneuver for geopolitical advantage. All of these things are rooted in the same system, and it makes sense for people who want to end any part of this to take up the fight against all of it. And in particular, there's the quotation, which is so powerful all the time, but especially now, from Bob Avakian, about you can't break all the chains but one. You can't say you want to end exploitation and oppression, but keep women oppressed by men. And there is a challenge right now for people to really look at what a lot of people don't want to look at, which is this war on women. It's painful to confront. It's daunting to confront. A lot of people want to be in denial. You're not living in Mississippi. You're not trying to figure out how to get 200 miles to a clinic. Where now they just introduced an even longer waiting period. The doctors fly in from out of state because it's dangerous to live there. They're only there a few days a week, and you have to drive hundreds of miles to get there, then stay. They want to make it where you have to see the doctor, then wait 3 days, 72 hours before you can get your abortion. How are you going to find childcare? How are you going to find housing? How are you going to bring up the resources for that? So maybe you don't live in Mississippi. Maybe you're in Los Angeles. Maybe you're somewhere else tuning in. It's easy to want to block that out. We can't block that out. That is the reality that is facing women right now, and it's the future of women across this country if we don't turn this around. And it's entirely possible to turn it around. I think that's one of the lessons also of this past summer. Is people standing up does make a difference.
Mm-hmm. We're talking with Sansara Taylor from Revolution Newspaper, revcom.us, and stoppatriarchy.org. Sansara, that's exactly where I was looking at going. And part of this I wanted to talk about, too, is that you and Carl Dix recently did a video that's available for people to see up on revcom.us. And I'd really recommend that people go and watch that, because it's just got right to the point in what you've been talking about in your last response. And one of the reasons why I played the John Lennon song this morning with the woman is the slave of the slave, and calling on people to actually stand up and recognize this. And I kept thinking about this where you guys were talking about that point about enslavement and the genocide against, you know, black people and brown people, and the enslavement and genocide against, you know, to a certain extent, it is a genocidal terror, not in the same way, but against women. And that whole point there. And then I was thinking about this. As I did that, I came on something else that was up on the RevCom site, which was a discussion or a polemic against these various Christian fascists, these black Christian fascists who are arguing. And this is something I think that comes out more than just from those nuts. It comes out in a big way in certain cities and certain across the country. The idea that, well, somehow abortion is not something that black people should fight for because it actually entails black genocide. Can we speak to that a little?
Yeah, I think this is very important, because this is one of the most poisonous and reactionary lies, the notion that black women who choose abortion and have access to abortion are somehow contributing to the genocide against black people. And this is something that these reactionary preachers, and a lot of reactionary black preachers in particular, have been promoting, the notion that black women getting abortions are committing genocide against their own people. And it's not true, and it's very vicious. I mean, they actually compare black women who choose abortions to racist white lynch mobs who lynched actual black people. Can you imagine accusing a black woman who's taking control, who's making her own decision about her own reproduction, and to equate that to the terror that was unleashed throughout centuries against black people at the hands of white supremacy and a slave society and then a Jim Crow society and then a new Jim Crow society. It's not black women committing this violence against black people. First of all, fetuses are not babies. They're not babies. Fetuses and embryos are part of a woman's body. It is her body. If you're saying that a woman cannot terminate a fetus, you are saying she is nothing more than an incubator. And let's just be straight up about it. That view that women in general are nothing more than incubators, and that, in particular, the view that black women are nothing more than breeders, that's the same view the slave masters had. This is just reactionary poison. And then to put the veneer, they always try to put this veneer of, concern for black people over this woman-hating agenda. But I'll tell you this, too. You never hear a word. I haven't heard a single thing from these preachers who are trumpeting this black genocide BS about abortion. I haven't heard a word from them about Tamir Rice. I haven't heard a word from them about Oscar Grant, about Mike Brown, about Eric Garner, about Ramarlee Graham, about the names go on and on. The actual genocide that is happening against black people has nothing to do with abortion, because abortion is not murder. It has nothing to do with black women controlling their reproduction. It has to do with murder by police. It has to do with mass incarceration. It has to do with the worst medical care that is, you know, that black people are relegated into. It has to do with the structures of white supremacy that need to be fought against, that are part of this system, every bit as much as the oppression of women is part of this system. And so this idea, you know, they try to cloak themselves in this lie that they care, that they're motivated by concern over black people, but actually that's just a veneer to fool people and to cover up what is really a reactionary and woman-hating agenda, and an agenda that is aimed at the enslavement of half of humanity and the demonizing and the shaming of black women in particular to carry out that agenda. And it really is poison. I'll tell you, oppressed people should not go for that. They should not go for that. They have to reject that. We have to be a part of standing up and fighting against all forms of enslavement. And that means fighting for women to have control over their bodies, over their destinies, abortion on demand and without apology. That means fighting against the real genocide and oppression affecting black people, standing up against the system that is doing this to them, and building the links between these struggles.
Mm-hmm. Now, Sansara, I have a question that I'm going to ask you that I really want to ask you, and we have about 6 minutes, I think, to get an answer on it. It's something that you began to speak to, but I was thinking about this in relation to the video you made with Carl. Also, the fact that on New Year's Eve, you were out in Times Square and you were under the banner of you spoke at the Rocking the New Year with resistance to police murder. No new year under the old system. We can't breathe. That march on New Year's Eve in New York City. You know, you've been very active in the fight around, you know, the oppression of women, as is obvious in terms of what we've been talking about for many years. But also, this point that you raised earlier in the discussion about being a communist and looking to revolution, you are about making revolution and you are about bringing on a new society, socialism and the transition to communism. And I want to talk about that at the same time because you are, as you said, you are about building this battle and these various battles, but building this one in particular, let's focus on that for next weekend and taking off from there. And how you see that relationship and then your vision off of that, your vision of what next week should look like.
Okay, good. Well, there are two things that everybody should know about the Revolutionary Communist Party, which is the party that I support. It's the party that Revolution Newspaper is the voice of, and it's the party that Bob Avakian leads. And here's the two things. One, that this movement and this party comes at everything from the perspective of building up the strength and preparing the people and preparing the vanguard and preparing the grounds to make an actual revolution, to be prepared for the time when millions can be led to go all out to take this system down, to dismantle this system with a real chance to win and a chance to bring into being a far different liberating socialist system leading to a communist world, a society that would break all of these chains. And we're coming at that because that's what it's going to take to get free. And so we come at everything that way. At the same time, we recognize and we unite within these struggles everybody who can be won to stand up against these outrages from whatever perspective they're coming from. And we want to get into that. We want to have struggle over that. We want to learn from others, and we are hoping that they would learn from us about where this ultimately needs to go. But right now, and this is something that's been a hallmark of the Revolutionary Communist Party and this movement for revolution, a hallmark of it is to go out and unite all who can be united against the real enemy. And so it is urgent. And it is good, you know, in a movement like StopPatriarchy.org, there's all kinds of different people coming from different viewpoints, as there should be. They don't all agree with me on all of this, but they're coming together with the recognition, and more people need to join us in that movement with the recognition that unless we step out there and fight back, unless we resist, unless we rely on ourselves and mobilize the anger and the outrage of many others that has been suppressed that needs to come forward, unless we do that, these rights of women will continue to be stripped away and women will be slammed backwards. And if we get out there, we can put a stop to this. If we go out there, we challenge people and we confront the women haters, which is what we're calling on people to do. On January 22nd, we're going to D.C. to confront the anti-abortion March for Life, to confront the women haters in front of the Supreme Court. On January 23rd, we're going to be in Oscar Grant Plaza, where these reactionary black preachers have the nerve to hold a rally blaming black women for genocide, for choosing abortions at Oscar Grant Plaza. We're going to counter-protest them there. And then on January 24th in San Francisco and in Austin, we're calling on people and mobilizing people to stand up and protest, again, the marches for life, the so-called marches for life, which are really a march for female enslavement. And all of this you can find at StopPatriarchy.org. And more information about the strategy and the vision of this movement for revolution, how to actually win and win real liberation, lasting liberation. You can find it at revcom.us. So how'd I do? Is that 6 minutes?
Yeah, you brought it in actually maybe a minute under. So I'm just going to comment on one thing is that, listen, all you folks out there, I don't care who you are, where you are, what you're doing, you need to get your butt in gear and be involved in all this over the next period of time. And in particular, make your decision about what you're going to do when you're looking at these things like the demonstrations in San Francisco and Washington and all the other things that Sansar was just talking about. Sansar, always a pleasure talking with you, and have you back soon, I hope.
All right. Thanks so much, Michael.
Okay, take care now. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we've just been talking with Sansara Taylor, a correspondent for RevCom.us and Revolution Newspaper, and an initiator of Stop Patriarchy. She helped organize and spoke at the Rock in the New Year with Resistance to Police Murder, No New Year Under This Old System, We Can't Breathe March on New Year's Eve in New York City. Last summer, she took on the war on women during the Abortion Rights Freedom Ride in Texas, which was ground zero in the assault on abortion rights. And right now she's in the forefront of standing up to these Christian fascists and the whole new culture, the whole new wave of woman-hating whatever is going on against, across the country, that whole new wave of onslaught of attacks against women and their right to be human beings, all right? All right, we got a little bit of time now before we have to go, so I wanted to seize the time and let you hear the video that I referred to earlier during our discussion with Sansara. And this is a call from Carl Dix from the Revolutionary Communist Party and the Stop Mass Incarceration Network and Sansara Taylor. Check this out.
Hi, I'm Sansara Taylor.
And I'm Carl Dix, and we're here to challenge and invite you to be with us in the streets to take on the women haters and their war on women this month in Washington, D.C. and in San Francisco.
Because look, there is a raging torrent of hatred against women in this society and in this world. It flows from the frat houses to the barracks, from the boardrooms to the state houses. It flows from the detention centers to the prisons. Women are brutalized, women are raped, women are ridiculed, women walk every day surrounded by a culture saturated by violent and degrading pornography. LGBT people are discriminated against and hatred assaults them as well. This is a society that should not be tolerated. But one of the most concentrated fronts of this war on women is the all-out Christian fascist assault on women's right to abortion and even birth control. And this is an assault that is backed by the state. Hundreds of laws have been passed that have restricted and closed down abortion clinics across this country. Now let's be clear, having a child if you want to have a child can be a beautiful thing. But being forced to have a child against your will, that's a form of enslavement. Forcing women to have children against their will traps them in abusive relationships. It drives them into poverty or deeper into poverty. It forecloses their dreams and ambitions and their contributions to the broader society. This is an assault that must not be tolerated. And this January 22nd in D.C. and 24th in San Francisco, these so-called right-to-lifers are organizing this huge hundreds of thousands of people to march against women's right to abortion. They call it a march for life, but really it's a march for female enslavement. And they're going to be celebrating their victories from 2014, braying and crowing about all the clinics they closed down, all the women they shamed. And they're going to be whipping up their foot soldiers for even greater violence against women, even more bludgeoning of women's rights in 2015. This must be opposed. So we're going to be there on the front lines, in the streets with others. Join us in protest to raise the demand. Women are not incubators. Fetuses are not babies. Abortion is not murder. And we will fight against this war on women. We will oppose and confront these women haters in person in the streets.
Look, like Sansara says, this war on women goes through every aspect of this society. It's totally illegitimate. It must be stopped. And it's up to us to stop it. And look, I've been a leader in the fight to stop the slow genocide of mass incarceration and police terror. And a lot of you all have been out there in the streets along with me taking that on. I want to say something special to you. You got to go from being fighters on one front to fighters on all fronts. I've been coming at this as a revolutionary communist. I understand that the horror of police murder, the horror of mass incarceration, the horror of this war on women, and all the horrors that people face today here in this country and around the world stem from the very nature of this capitalist imperialist system. And it's going to take revolution, nothing less, to get rid of it once and for all. We got to go from being fighters on one front to fighters on all fronts, taking on all forms of oppression. It's like B.A. says, you can't break all the chains but one. You can't be fighting to end that oppression that comes down on you, but then let's keep these chains that bind women into subordinate positions in society. No, we got to fight to end all the oppression. And doing this and taking on this war on women is an important part of getting ready and in position for an actual revolution that can sweep away this system and end all of these horrors. So join us. Join me in Washington, D.C. on January 22nd. You can also go out to the West Coast, or if you're out there on January 24th, be in the streets there. Abortion on demand without apology.
Women are not bitches, hoes, punching bags, breeders, or sex objects. Women are full human beings.
Break the chains.
Unleash the fury of women as a mighty force for revolution.
All right, once again, that was Carl Dix from the Stop Mass Incarceration Network and the Revolutionary Communist Party, and Sansara Taylor from Revolution Newspaper, RevCom.us, and StopPatriarchy.org. And you've heard both of these people on my show many times over the years, and this is one of the first times that you've heard them together. And it's about a very, very important event coming up, about a very important battle in society, and that is up against the knuckle-dragging fascists, Christian fascists, and other fascists who have launched an all-out assault, an all-out war against women, and the fight to stop that, to stand up against that, and calling on everyone, people who might not have ever thought of themselves as being marching down the street with people fighting against the oppression of women, who might not have even ever thought of themselves as taking this kind of battle up. All kinds of people, from people fighting the crisis in the environment, to people fighting against the genocidal incarceration of black and brown youth, fighting against the genocidal slaughter of black and brown people from the police all over the country, or people who have been standing up and fighting against women's oppression for quite some time, including around, most specifically around, the spear point of this whole assault and the spear point of the fight back against it, which is the battle for the right to have an abortion, all right? Saying clearly, loud and clearly, that, and this is all part of building the strongest possible fight to stop the war on women. Abortion on demand and without apology. Forced motherhood is female enslavement. Oppose slavery in every form. And I don't care what you're doing to stand up against whatever other heinous crime that this system has committed, make sure that you hook up with this movement and this fight to stop the war on women. And once again, you can go to revcom.us to find out a whole lot more information on it. And you can go to stoppatriarchy.org as well. And find out how you can hook up with this movement and be part of changing the world. All right. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show. And I want to thank all of my guests today, Sansara Taylor and Dr. Terry Coopers. I want to thank my assistant producer, Henry Carson, my production assistant, Jeff Pryor, my board offer today, Teddy Robinson, and all of you for tuning in. If you want to write to me, you can at michaelslate@redfuture.com. All right. That's michaelslate@redfuture.com. We're going out now with Outer National and Here Is the Rose. You're getting in a mischief, I'm listening. I wanna hear your thoughts, see it all. Like a hidden web through the walls. You wanna go out tonight, you want to know what it's like when the wind's in your lungs and the fire is in those.